Welcome to episode 15 of season 2 of Travels Through Time. Hello, I'm Artemis, and today we're talking about the year 1215 and its significance on the intellectual landscape of medieval Europe. Giles Gasper is professor in high medieval history at Durham University, with a special interest in religious and intellectual culture. He was educated at Oxford and Toronto and has been at Durham since 2004. As one of my tutors, usually when I see Giles, he asks me questions about medieval history, but this time it was the other way around. He talked to me primarily in his role as principal investigator of the Ordered Universe Project, an interdisciplinary academic group who translate, contextualise and analyse the scientific works of Robert Grosseteste. Giles describes Grosseteste as one of the most dazzling minds of his generation. He was an English scholastic philosopher, theologian and scientist who lived between 1170 and 1253. His works concerning the generation of sound, light, colour, and the universe are of a highly original and imaginative nature, and in today's episode we discuss his 1215 astronomical treatise on the sphere. 1215 also bore witness to the creation of Magna Carta and to the Fourth Council of the Lateran in Rome, where, amongst other things, the doctrine of transubstantiation was made official. I spoke to Giles about this monumental year for medieval history, appropriately, in the historic centre of Durham just the other day. So, hi Giles, thank you so much for joining us today on Travels Through Time.
Pleasure.
I thought we could start by you telling us a bit about the Ordered Universe Project and what kind of things do you get up to and how can listeners get involved with it if they're interested?
Brilliant. The Ordered Universe Project runs from three universities in the UK, so from Durham, Oxford and York, with partners across the globe, so particularly in Georgetown in Washington, McGill in Montreal, Tor Vergata in Italy in the University of Rome, and in Beirut at the American University of Beirut. Simply put, the aim of the project is to investigate and analyse the scientific works of Robert Grosseteste, who was one of the most dazzling minds of his generation, born in 1170, dies in 1253, is Bishop of Lincoln for the last 20 years or so of his life. But we're focused on the first stage of his life, really from about 1195 to about 1230, when he's writing an extraordinary series of works which pull together new learning, or learning that's new to Western scholars, in particular the reception of Aristotle and other Greek thinkers like Ptolemy, but with commentaries and other works from Islamicate authors, figures like Ibn Sina, mm-hmm. better known as Avicenna, mm-hmm. and Ibn Rushd, better known as Averroes, and a whole host of others. But what makes the group remarkable is that we're a group of medieval specialists of various sorts, philosophers, historians, Latinists, and modern scientists. Mm. So we're looking at this series of works that Grosseteste writes. He has a number of different genres that he moves through. So he writes a couple of big commentaries, one finished, one not, on Aristotle's Posterior Analytics and on Aristotle's Physics. But he also writes this sequence of shorter works, which started about 1195, and the final one on the rainbow is finished in about 1230. They go through a series of different phenomena, either cosmological or meteorological, as he would put it, but it's topics like colour, sound. He has a wonderful treatise on light, which is really about body and the notion of how you get form and matter to move and self-replicate. Mm. And he thinks about this in terms of the biggest body he can imagine, which is the universe, and it has this remarkable theory of how the physical universe, as he understood it to be, comes into being. So it's a wide range of topics. The range of interdisciplinary skills is very, very unusual. We thought when we started this 10 years ago that it would be a question of the humanities group doing humanities work. So we would translate the text, we'd edit the text, which are complicated things to do, and then the scientists would just help us with a bit of the analysis and articulation. And what's emerged is a much more collaborative venture where scientists training how they read the text is quite different to the way that humanities do. So you've got a lovely combination of working through the logic of the text. How is he looking at this phenomena? We can do the source material so we can follow and track Grosseteste's exploration of the different sources that he's looking at. We can provide editions and modern English translations. And this is really important because Grosseteste from the 1950s, a famous book by Alistair Crombie, put him at the beginning of the Western experimental scientific method. Now, the boldness of that claim was criticised almost immediately, but nevertheless, Grosseteste has this interesting place in the history of science, and we've been slowly unpicking and exploring that reputation. And then the wider implications of this are a really in-depth exploration of science in culture. What does it mean for Grosseteste to make these explorations? What was his educational background? Where is he? What's he doing? Mm. But also, because this is natural phenomena that he's describing, you can use the modern understanding of that as an additional toolkit to think about how we might interpret that.
Mm.
A really interesting example is the treatise on colour and on the rainbow. Grosseteste uses his theory of colour, which he articulates, we could understand it as three-dimensional, so he articulates two qualities of light on bipolar axes, so light is either a lot or a little, or concentrated or dispersed, and one of the medium in which it's embodied, the medium is either pure or impure. Colour is light embodied in something diaphanous or something transparent.
Mm-hmm.
He uses that theory in his treatise on rainbow to explain the differences in colour between rainbows and within a rainbow.
Mm.
And that gives us a fixed point because allowing for atmospheric pollution, which we did with a colleague at the European Space Agency whose expertise that is, a rainbow is the same in the 13th century as it is in the 21st.
Mm.
And our vision scientist colleague Hannah Smithson in Oxford, Experimental Psychology and Pembroke College, Hannah modelled how you might see a rainbow in human colour vision space using Grosseteste's model, and it's quite extraordinary what emerged. And it turns out that nobody in science had modelled how humans see natural rainbows.
Since the early 13th century?
Yeah, well, nobody at all in scientific,
really?
The scientific community. So it's a really interesting piece of new science that's come out of and been inspired by engaging with 13th century science.
No, it's fascinating. I know I've seen the pictures on the website and stuff, which I'll include a link to and things, of like you all get together for seminars and discuss his works.
So the methods are quite old-fashioned. It was my colleague Tom McLeish, who was Pro Vice Chancellor for Research in Durham, who instigated the whole thing with me about 10 years ago, because he'd heard about Grosseteste. He's a physicist himself, but he'd heard about Grosseteste from a colleague in Leeds. He'd been to a history of science talk, and he's particularly interested in the history of theology and physics as well. But from that meeting, Tom and I started to put together a reading group, and we've carried on that methodology. Mm. So we meet about two or three times a year as a group, and we read through a text line by line, paragraph by paragraph, the English translation, we have the Latin with us, and everybody pitches in and gives their opinion and view. And then from that, we have the slightly longer process of collaborative writing.
Mm.
So the main outputs from the project are six volumes with Oxford University Press. The first one came out in November. So we've got another five to go.
Congratulations.
We've got another five to go. And then these other publications, so we do papers in scientific journals, we do papers in more humanities journals, and we do a lot of more popular literature in magazines or online.
So I think we're going to look more specifically at the treatise on the sphere.
That's right,
later on for our last scene. But for now, you've chosen the year 1215 to travel back in time to. Could you tell us a bit about the year 1215 and what made you choose it, and kind of give the listeners some context about what's going on in that year?
Yes, well, 1215 is a very interesting and famous year within English history, but also within the history of the European Middle Ages. If we take a slightly broader view, 1215 is quite important in global history because it's the year in which Genghis Khan really seriously moves into China. So this is part of the Mongol expansion of the early 13th century into the 1220s, and it's the Mongol final expansion into China and across the steppe lands, which seismically changes the political, economic and social map of Eurasia during the 13th and 14th centuries. So we can take that longer view. It's important to do that for many reasons. One is to actually understand how connected medieval societies were. I think a good analogy for this is actually thinking about Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings and the Hobbits in the Shire. Most of the Hobbits don't move very far, but some of them do.
Mm.
And we can see travellers, traders, scholars, churchmen lots of people in the Middle Ages do make these extraordinary journeys, and it's different communities then travelling one from the other.
Mm.
You can track trade routes, and on trade routes you can also track trafficking in ideas.
Mm.
So we'll come back to Grosseteste's treatise on the sphere, which we think was composed in around this time, but in that treatise, though he's writing about the universe and the world, he uses an example of an Indian city, which is widely thought in the West as the centre of the world.
Oh, really?
The city of Arim. So though he's not going anywhere beyond, I think he goes to France a couple of times.
Mm.
So he's not particularly well-travelled himself, but conceptually they do think of the world as round. There's no flat Earth society.
Oh, really?
In the Middle Ages, that's a 19th century myth.
That's so interesting. I didn't know that.
In a sense, getting 1215 in its global context is quite important. The key events of 1215 that I would flag up here are the Magna Carta,
which we'll get to in a moment.
Which brings to a temporary conclusion the struggles between King John and rebel barons.
Mm.
It's also the moment of perhaps the most important church council of the Middle Ages, the Fourth Lateran Council.
Mm-hmm.
So in important ways, 1215 is a useful route in for time travelling into the Middle Ages. This is a year quite momentous in its implications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the first scene that we're visiting is the signing of, or the creation of, the Magna Carta, which is such a famous document that I really want to unpack what it actually is, because it's kind of used and abused so much amongst modern commentators. Let's talk about where it was drawn up, who was there, who would have been responsible for writing it.
Yeah, sure. There's lots of specialist scholarship on this, particularly with the anniversary in 2015.
So yes.
I'd stress that one pulls on that work, particularly scholars, including Stephen Church and Nicholas Vincent. 1215 is the moment where Magna Carta comes into existence. It wasn't signed. That's another myth. Medieval documents of that sort aren't signed as sealed. It would have taken place at Runnymede. It's a series of agreements between the senior baronage and the king. The Archbishop Stephen Langton had a considerable amount to do with the drafting of it, and seems to do some shuttle diplomacy between the rebel barons and King John.
Mm-hmm.
The 1215 version actually doesn't remain legal for very long, but neither side sticks to its agreements. In fact, John actually gets the charter. That's all it means, Magna Carta, the big charter, the great charter. He gets it annulled by Pope Innocent III about 3 months later and puts England under papal jurisdiction, so England becomes a papal fiefdom, which it remains for quite some time afterwards. There are then a series of reissues of Magna Carta, but for that we need to understand the complex political life of the period from John's death until 1225 or so. So Magna Carta emerges in some senses as a result of the complexities and efficiencies of Angevin government. That's the dynasty that rules in England and other places from Henry II through to Henry III. Angevin kingship was quite aggressive, quite intrusive. The rights of the king to various obligations, payments in particular, were ruthlessly exploited. And this gets more intense after 1204, when John loses to Philip Augustus the crown lands in Normandy. So Normandy had been part of John's inheritance, and Philip manoeuvres a situation where he, as overlord, can take over Normandy. So John loses that. John's very keen to get this back, so he pulls even more on the English sources of revenue, and Ireland as well, which had been a royal interest since the 1170s. So part of Magna Carta is a baronial reaction to this more aggressive and more incursive kingship. So it's about how the relationship between the king and lordship works, what is reasonable for the king to demand and what is unreasonable. They propose a whole series of clauses. These range from quite local, so there's a clause about fish traps on the Medway, which is quite close to Runnymede, where the final meeting took place, to grander principles. Langton was probably responsible for the first clause, which states that the church is to be free.
Mm.
So it's an important statement in a sense of defining and limiting kingship. And in that sense, it deserves its place in the story of parliamentary democracy and the liberal tradition, though we shouldn't necessarily draw a straight line because history doesn't work in that way.
Of course, yeah. No, that was going to be my next question, because it's something that every school child learns about in, you know, the Magna Carta, it's so famous. And I guess you've kind of answered this question already, but just to elaborate on a bit on it some more, what role did it have to play in the development of the English legal and political system?
It is an important statement. It's important to contextualise that too. I mean, it's revisited significantly in the 17th century. It becomes an important document in the American Declaration of Independence. Mm. But that's a slightly different tradition, a different way of looking at it. Within its own days, as I said, Magna Carta itself, the 1215 version, only lasts for 3 months. Why it remains important is because of the actions of the minority government after John's death. So John, after the annulment of Magna Carta, faces another serious rebellion from his baronage. This is supported by the French monarchy, so not Philip Augustus himself, but his son Louis invades the south of England, and they control a great deal of the southeast and East Anglia. This is important because when John dies, Newark, and he's then buried in Worcester, his son is not of age, so he's a minor. There then has to be a regency, and they have to shore up royal government and the claims of the king with both the rebellion but also hostile forces. They're only ruling a certain amount of the country. One of the things that they do is to reissue Magna Carta, because this then becomes a touchstone of not only loyalty to the king, but also that there is going to be a negotiation with the barons. 1216 runs its course. In 1217, the Regency government wins militarily, so the Battle of Lincoln, and then the naval battle that follows, and the French reinforcements are insufficient, and it's gradually the rebel barons move over to the royal camp. And this is all then sealed and done and dusted in 1217. And there's then a series of other charters that are released, so the famous Charter of the Forests, another reissue of Magna Carta, and this is part of the reconstruction of royal administration, because things are in quite a complicated state and you've got a lot of power being left to sheriffs or to castellans. These are men that dominate castles, and reasserting royal control. And one of the tools that's used is Magna Carta in its reissue. So from being a document issued in a sense against the king in 1215, it becomes a tool of royal government in the later half of the 1210s and 1220s. And 1225 is the important reissue at the point where Henry III is entering into his majority, and that's the version, bits of which are still on the statute book. Now, it gets reissued a few other times in the 13th century. There's a bigger dispute between Henry III and elements of his baronage, including Simon de Montfort. That happens in the 1250s and early 60s. And again, part of the response later is that Edward I is very keen to reissue Magna Carta, and it becomes a kind of touchstone of responsible government. And it's last issued in the early 14th century.
So from one statement of, or kind of exploration of, political authority in the sense of the development of kingship, if it's okay, I'd like to move to the second scene you've chosen, which is the Fourth Lateran Council.
Yes,
and about
indeed.
That's about the development of papal authority.
Yes.
Could you tell us a bit about where the council would have taken place, and what, you know, what would it have been like?
Well, it's quite an extraordinary moment. So the Lateran Council, in a sense, is its beginnings are in 1213, and this is the brainchild and main project, in a sense, of Pope Innocent III. Very energetic, reforming Pope who takes his responsibilities as the Vicar of Christ, as he calls himself, for the pastoral care of the whole of the Church. We can define the Church in two ways, as Church officers or as all Christians, and the responsibilities of the Church for the salvation and good health, in a moral sense, of the population that they are given responsibility for. So it starts the process in 1213. The council itself starts to gather in November 1215, and it's huge. So there's over 1,000 delegates, bishops, metropolitans, abbots, there's representatives of various monarchs. So there's an attempt to make this the most authoritative and the most grand statement of church doctrine. So it's counted in the Western tradition as an ecumenical council. Ecumenical councils have enormous authority. This is the gold-plated standard of a church document that you can get.
What were they meeting to discuss, and what were the main conclusions of it?
So a lot of it is about how you regulate church officers, so how monks are to behave, how bishops are to behave. Some of it is about more general statements that impinge on the laity. So it's in Lateran 4 that we see the notion that all people should make their confession at least once a year. This then fuels a pastoral care revolution, in a sense, in the 13th century, with confession manuals being a very important source. It's not that confession didn't exist beforehand, but it makes it mandatory. It has theological implications. So Lateran 4 is the first full articulated statement of the doctrine of transubstantiation.
Yes.
It deals with heresy. So the Cathar heresy had been identified and makes its appearance. The war against the Cathars had started a few years earlier. It also has important clauses about crusade, with the papacy really making it a papal responsibility for crusade. That's a development and a debate that had been happening throughout the 12th century, and in it, essentially, could say that Lateran IV defines crusade. The Fourth Crusade had been diverted to Constantinople. This is early in Innocent's reign as Pope, and I think he was anxious that that shouldn't be repeated, and papal direction was very important. It has other clauses, so it has clauses about Jewish communities. There are ways of interpreting that as part of a ongoing and worsening relationship between Christian and Jewish communities, so the notion that Jews should be marked out by particular clothing, those clauses are there in that, and we can see relationships with Jewish communities, particularly in England and France, getting steadily worse as the 13th century goes on, in the English case leading to the expulsion of Jewish communities under Edward I. So it's an extremely wide-ranging document. It covers practice in the church, it covers practice amongst the laity, it covers theology, it covers crusade, and it covers relationships with other faiths.
And how long would it have taken everybody to sit there and discuss it all, if that's so far-reaching?
So as I said, the preparations for this start a couple of years earlier. This is under Innocent's direction, but a lot of other people involved in the drafting of the statements, and the council itself takes place over several weeks and months.
And you spoke a bit about the Cathars. Would you like to tell us a bit more about them?
So the Cathars are interesting. This is a heresy which is sort of first identified, in fact, by Bernard of Clairvaux in some of his sermons on the Song of Songs. It starts to talk about this new heresy that's arisen. Obviously, there are heresies from the early church, as Bernard points out in that sermon, which have human origins. So we can talk about Nestorius, the Nestorian heresy. We can talk about Marni and the Manichees. We can talk about Donatus and the Donatists. But he says this one we don't know who started it. So he attributes it to diabolical agents. They're identified, these communities, as Manichees by 12th and 13th century clerics. In a sense, that gives you an evidential complication, because it's using then a early church heresy. So interpreting exactly what Cathars thought is quite tricky. And then finding the evidence for what they actually thought is, again, a little more complicated than one might imagine, because you've only got the evidence of heresy trials, or occasionally people that have converted back from Catharism to Orthodox Christianity, to Catholicism. But obviously they're denigrating their previous beliefs. So actually finding full-blown Cathar sources is not easy. But it seems to be particularly common across Northern Italy, and particularly in Languedoc in the south of France, a little bit into Northern Spain as well. Insofar as one can tell the beliefs, it seems to be a dualist faith, so that's an easy identification with Manichae, with Manichae religion. Manichaeists believed in two forces, one of light, one of dark, good and evil, in a kind of cosmic battle. The Cathars seem to reject the Old Testament, they reject parts of the New Testament. They have their own church, by all understandings. They debate with local Catholic communities, so they have an organisation. Whether, in fact, the Cathar heresy is quite the threat that churchmen make it to be is an interesting question. But there's clearly a lot of effort that goes into arguing against it. The first efforts were led by the Cistercians. These weren't particularly successful. The Dominican order emerges as a real response to Cathars. So the Dominicans set themselves up to preach against the Cathars in their own territory. And then there's the military option. Innocent III adopts and approves of, although it's rapidly running out of papal control, there is a sense in which you can look at the Cathar Wars as an imposition of northern French control over the south, but there are other dimensions to that. So we have a crusade against the Cathars led by Simon of Montfort, who's the father of Simon de Montfort. And this is taking place from the 1207 or so up to about 1223, and then it lingers on until 1244. There are still Cathar communities in some senses into the 14th century. A very famous book called Montaillou by the French scholar Emmanuel Le Roy Ladurie follows an inquisitor, because the Inquisition exists by this stage, where he's taking a village, and you can see quite far down into the social scale at that point and see the interactions in the village.
And I'm quite interested to know as well that if the implications that Magna Carta had on the development of kingship and kingly authority, what implications did Lateran IV have for the development of papal monarchy? And is there a sense that anxiety about heresy goes hand in hand with an assertion of papal authority?
Very interesting questions. And in a sense, you can see papal authority being articulated through the 12th century. So as the name implies, there had been three previous councils at the Lateran Church. So starting in the 1120s, moving through until we get to the Fourth Lateran Council. And in a sense, you can see that as part of the process of increasing papal administration of justice as it pertains to the church. There is, in a sense, that monarchical claim. The Pope, although it's not a hereditary monarchy, the Pope has many of the trappings of monarchy. He has a crown. And you can see the papacy, in a sense, starting to lead Christendom. And the case then is supported by the bishops and by other senior clergy, including the monasteries. So Lateran IV, in a sense, marks a high watermark for Innocent's reign and for a sequence of reforming popes up to that. And it's a very grand statement of what the church should be and what it could be. And as I said, it then spawns this real revolution in pastoral care that we see in the 13th century.
Yes, and the relationship between the priest and the layman develops with the development of transubstantiation, because that's about elevating the role of the priest and, you know, the sacred role that he plays when in the performance of the sacraments and the Eucharist and things like that.
Again, yes, and that had been part of the conversation in the 12th century, so sacramental theology is a big part of that. But we could connect that back, in a sense, to Cathar heresy or other heretical movements which reject the material and prioritise the spiritual over the material. In a sense, transubstantiation is putting the material back, that this is the body and blood of Christ. This is something very material and tangible. A little earlier, you have the assertion of the bodily assumption of the Virgin Mary into heaven. Again, this is saying the body is not to be rejected as inherently evil because it's material, that the body is redeemable, it is important. So in a sense, you can see this as part of a broader conversation.
Yeah.
About material and spiritual.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So I think we should move on to our final scene, because Robert Grosseteste is like the star of the show for you. Would you say that's fair?
Well, he's certainly a
favourite.
A favourite in our household, and I suspect of many others in the group. I have a colleague whose wife times him when they're having dinner parties or occasions as to how long it will be before he talks about all the universe and Grosseteste. It's one of our physics colleagues.
That's so funny. I mean, we spoke a bit about his life and his works at the beginning, but maybe you could tell us a bit more about where he was based, where he was working. And also, I would like to know, was he unique? Is there a sense that he was like a genius in the way we think about it today?
In a sense. I mean, I think he's a very, very clever bloke.
Yeah.
Probably one of those slightly annoying people that's good at everything they turn their hands to. We're not entirely sure what he's doing, although you can actually piece together pretty much a biography, and it's not at all uncommon not to know very much about medieval scholars or medieval people unless they reach a position where documentation is kept. So we know a great deal about what he was doing when he was bishop. And in a sense, he is actually of that Lateran IV generation, so he's a very energetic reforming bishop. Galloping around his diocese, he's Bishop of Lincoln, which is huge in the Middle Ages. It's the biggest of the English dioceses. It stretches from the Wash to the Thames. Number of archdeaconries, 1,000 to 2,000 parishes. So it's a huge amount of territory and people. But Grosseteste is very keen that he should visit the places in the diocese and ensure that pastoral care by his clergy is being issued and given out to the people properly. Before 1235, the data on where he is a little patchy. If we work backwards, we know he himself describes his career as in three phases. First, he was a cleric, then he was a master in theology, and then he was a bishop. He gets his first benefice, his first clerical post, only in 1225, and this is he's rector of Abbotsley in Lincolnshire Diocese. Presumably at that point he's working in the Oxford schools because he seems to be given the title Master of the Scholars, not Chancellor, and that seems to be something, a role he was playing in the late 1220s, not the long-standing myth that he was Chancellor of Oxford University in 1215, which would give us another 1215 moment. Before 1225, it's a little patchy, so we don't quite know when he was born. We know he was very old when he died, so if we start to put together a career, if we assume that he's in his 80s when he died, that's not impossible or implausible for medieval clerics. Many of them are really quite old and of the same age. Stephen Langton was in his 70s when he died, Anselm was 76, Lanfranc was in his 80s, these are all Archbishops of Canterbury. We could posit a date of birth around 1170. He first emerges in the historical record in a charter for the Bishop of Lincoln, where he's named as master, and that's probably in the early 1190s. We then know that his first post was an attachment to the household of Bishop William de Vere, the Bishop of Hereford. In about 1195, we have a letter of recommendation written by the wonderful, slightly acerbic scholar Gerald of Wales, which highlights three things: that Grosseteste is good at law, he's good at medicine, and he's a very careful and thoughtful companion, good for pastoral care. Mm. And you can see all three of those interests as Grosseteste's life continues. 1198, Bishop William dies, and the household dissolves. This is a normal practice. The bishopric is then not filled for a couple of years, and we don't see Grosseteste attached to the next bishops of Hereford, but he's probably being supported by the Archdeacon of Shropshire within Hereford Diocese, Hugh Folliot, who'd been Archdeacon for a long time. Eventually he becomes Bishop of Hereford himself in 1219, and you can see Grosseteste dropping in to the diocese at key moments. He himself recalls on his deathbed that he'd been in France, he doesn't specify where, but we presume Paris and other places, in the interdict over England. So this is part of the prolegomena to 1215 and the signing of the sealing of Magna Carta, that the Pope and John had come to loggerheads, particularly over the appointment of the Archbishop of Canterbury, Stephen Langton. John refuses to recognise the papal nomination. And eventually the whole of the country is put under John is personally excommunicated, and the whole of the country, England and Wales, is put under papal interdict. That means that most of the senior clergy go into exile. Archdeacons on the whole stay, but the bishops on the whole go into exile. A lot of them go to France and to Paris. Grosseteste recalls that he heard several people preaching, and you can say from the people and the relative dating that he's certainly in France in around 1213. So perhaps he had been sent there by Folliot to keep an eye on the Bishop of Hereford, who is also in exile there. So he might well be in France from 1208 to 1314. The edict isn't finally settled until 1214. After that point, we see him acting as a papal judge delegate, part of the reconstruction of papal justice in England in probably between 1213 and 16. He probably wasn't moving to Paris or to France during the First Barons' War. We had a very difficult time to travel. He was probably involved in helping Hugh Folliot reconstruct Hereford Diocese when Hugh becomes bishop. It may be that Grosseteste goes to Paris for a while, because with the text that we're looking at, he calculates the meridian of Paris for his treatise on time reckoning. Treatise on comets talks about the occasion of the great comet. Now, if that's Halley's Comet, that's 1223. Mm-hmm. And that text, unusually for his treatises, has a French manuscript dissemination. So there are good reasons to point towards a stay in Paris. We then next find him signing a charter for the Bishop of Hereford between 1223 and 1226 for presenting a priest to a parish in the north of the diocese. And it's very interesting where he's placed in that. He's placed second in the witness list, and he's placed before the bishop's official, which is a new role, and is in a sense as the bishop's deputy. So that indicates quite a high status for him. He'd also written by this point a sort of textbook on pastoral care, the Templum Dei, the Temple of God. And that, I think, is part of his assistance to Hugh Folliot in terms of the pastoral regeneration of the diocese. And then, as I said, in 1225, we can see him with a proper benefice in Lincoln. Quite old when he gets that, so he's in his 50s when he gets his first post. But it's in this period that he's writing his wonderful creative treatments, largely of problems that you encounter in Aristotle's natural philosophy. And we think at this point, probably between 1215 and 1220, is when he writes his wonderful treatise on the sphere.
And this may seem like quite a simple question, but I think it's really important for understanding and taking yourself kind of back to the time.
Yeah.
How would he have written the treatise on the sphere?
Excellent questions. We don't know.
We don't know.
So it looks as if it emerges from the first piece that he writes, which is a treatise on the liberal arts. And that goes through the seven liberal arts. He spends more time on the quadrivium, which is the mathematical arts. So this is geometry, astronomy, music, and arithmetic. He doesn't spend long on arithmetic. Particularly spends a long time on astronomy. And in a sense, you can see themes from that emerging in this bigger treatise on the sphere, which takes you through the universe and the place of the earth within that. So a very clear statement at the beginning that the universe is spherical and that the world is spherical. It takes you through eclipses, the movement of the sun, how the zodiac operates, and then he ends up with how earth, the geography is formed, so dividing the world into its quadrants. The only habitable bit is obviously in the northern hemisphere. They don't believe that people can exist in the southern hemisphere. And the division of the world into climactic regions, climes as they call it, so between very hot and very cold, and then the temperate zones in the middle. And this is part of the reason why he's citing the city of Arim in India. This is part of the evidence for the world being spherical, that eclipses happen at different times in different places on the same latitude. So it's a beautiful and wide-ranging text. It's the longest of his shorter treatises. This is also a period where there are other places to go for higher study within England. There's still quite a famous school at Lincoln. There are other places for higher study. It's only really in the later 13th century that Oxford and Cambridge become the dominant ancient universities. What's unusual too about the De Sphaera on the sphere is that it is very popular. So we have over 50 manuscripts. Anything more than 10 manuscripts from the Middle Ages surviving means that it had a very wide dissemination. Most of the other treatises of this period are between 3 and 13 manuscripts. So this is a very wide dissemination. So it's clearly used by people, and it is a very interesting and straightforward guide to the topics that he's talking about, astronomy and geometry. There is a very similarly named treatise called On the Sphere by another Englishman, John Sacrobosco, John Hollywood. We think that was probably written just before Grosseteste's. Hollywood is even more popular than Grosseteste's and is used widely into the 17th century as a basic text for learning about astronomy. Grosseteste shortens and contracts some of Sacrobosco's work. He doesn't use classical allusions in the same way that Sacrobosco does. It's a much tighter and tauter explanation.
And we would characterise Grosseteste's work today as being scientific, but obviously he would not have used that word. I got the impression when I was reading some of his treatises that it's a lot of the time about trying to reconcile what he knows about theology and God with what he's observing with the world around him and kind of fitting the two together. Would you say that's fair?
Sort of. So I think you're right. Scientia has a much wider valence in the Middle Ages, so generally means knowledge. There is much less of a distinction between science and humanities, let's say. That's a more modern distinction. If we take his treatise on the liberal arts, he's making a case that the liberal arts, which are the seven subjects, it's not really a curriculum, it's more of a conceptual framework. Liberal arts are useful to correct human error, and it includes both what we would think of as mathematical subjects and also the arts of persuasion, so rhetoric, grammar and logic. So in a sense already there you've got this more holistic way of thinking about learning. That's the basic course that you do when you enter a university or higher education in the Middle Ages. It's liberal arts. It sort of transforms, because of the new learning that's coming in, particularly Aristotle, into natural philosophy. Whether he's thinking about his text as religious, I would probably characterise it slightly differently. What he's doing in these texts is explaining the physical universe. It is obviously a Christian universe, and there are some points where he has to deal with the fact that Aristotle is wrong from that worldview. So Aristotle's universe has no beginning and no end, steady state, as it were. Grosseteste has to deal with that. So when he's dealing in his text on light, which is a transformative moment in the 1220s, about 1225 we think that's written, he has to say that the universe begins because he knows it's going to end, because Genesis says so. He never cites that, but we can take that as an operating assumption. So yes, it's happening within a Christian framework, but no, in a sense, these texts are about explaining the physical universe. One of his contemporaries, John Blund, has a treatise where he's thinking about the soul, a topic Grosseteste also enters into, because the soul is a key part of how you get motion. So motion is what, motion and body are two absolutely key questions. How does motion start? How do bodies form? These are key to Aristotelian thought, and they're something that medieval scholars at this point are debating intensely. John Blund says, and he's using Avicenna a lot, which Grosseteste comes to a bit later, John Blund says, I'm not talking about the soul in its moral categories, that's for the theologian, I am talking about the physiology, how it operates within the body. So in that sense, I think Grosseteste is doing a very similar thing. He never invokes an argument from the divine in the treatises that he's looking at. So in a sense, he's thinking about what colour is, he's thinking about what movement is, rectilinear, circular, he's thinking about what sound is, how do we talk about that? And the reconciliation, in a sense, is with Aristotle and other authorities. So Grosseteste does appear to be very widely read, and with some quite recent stuff as well. So he's reading Aristotle in translations from Greek directly. This is the corpus translated by James of Venice in Constantinople, about 1150 or so. And then there's translations from Arabic, which are being translated mostly in Toledo by a chap called Gerard of Cremona. Grosseteste is inheriting these texts and thinking through them.
Well, I think just before we get to the end of our interview and we have to head back into the present day, would you like to tell us about a memento that you'd like to bring back from 1215? That's something that we like to do on this podcast.
Well, a couple of things.
Everyone always wants to take more than one thing.
When Grosseteste died, he didn't leave his library to Lincoln Cathedral because he had quite bad relationships with the cathedral. He leaves it instead to the Franciscan house in Oxford, which doesn't really survive anymore. But we have records of the friars in subsequent centuries looking at Grosseteste's works, including a wonderful set of thoughts really called the Dicta. But you can work out bits of what the Franciscan library would have looked like from shelf marks that are recorded in other manuscripts by other scholars. And there's a reference in one to an annotated copy or a copy of Abu Mashar, who's an interesting Islamic 8th thinker, particularly on astrology, that Grosseteste had glossed, had made notes on. And that would be very interesting to take back in there.
And it's lost.
So we don't have that surviving. The other thing that I might take, and this is a fiction of the period, so the English poet John Gower attributes to Grosseteste the building of a brass head which could answer all things. Now, this is later attributed to Roger Bacon by other authors, but the notion that Grosseteste had made this head that could answer all problems, that would be a fantastic thing to have.
That would be cool. Great. Well, thank you very much for talking to me this morning. I know you're very busy, so I'll let you get back. But yeah, thanks for coming on Travels Through Time.
Thank you.
That was me, Artemis Irvin, talking to Giles Gasper about the year 1215. I particularly enjoyed talking to Giles about the work they do at the Ordered Universe Project. It was exciting to see how such a diverse range of disciplines could come together so successfully. You can find out more about what they get up to at ordered-universe.com. Our next episode is a Valentine's Day special with Dr. Sophie Ratcliffe, so we'll be out on Friday.
Here's a clip of Peter talking to Sophie in her office at Oxford University last week.
I have lived much of my life through books. I wanted to be honest about the idea that imagination is part of our reality. So my story of love and death and trains is tied up with the story of two other people's love and death and trains. And so on the course of my journey, when I'm thinking about my life, we collide with two women. One was an American journalist who really lived, and her name was Kate Field. And the other was a Russian socialite who fictionally died, Anna Karenina.
Till then, goodbye.